Hello and welcome to episode number 366 of the Super Horror Bros podcast. I'm your host Matt, and joining me as always is my brother Mike.
Hello.
How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good.
We are back in the cinema with another new franchise installment. Much like last week, but as we said before, this is pretty much the counter opposite, going from a franchise that is very dear in our hearts to one that we're pretty, I don't know. I mean, what's your thoughts, I guess, surface level on The Exorcist? Let's just start
I like you going mad straight away, because I don't vividly hate it as much as you, so it's less fun. But I mean, I'm instantly like, oh yeah, we're back again. Like, we've been we're in the cinema seeing the spookies. I'm like, god damn it.
Yeah.
But, you know, The Exorcist is, it's a franchise that I don't hate like you, but I don't love it. Like, I liked the first one is, to me, like, fine when I watched it.
A glowing recommendation.
Yeah. And then is it Exorcist 3 is the one that people,
that's the one people it? Like, yeah, it's free.
Yeah. And like, I've got the Arrow Blu-ray of that, and I watched it and was like, yeah, right, okay. I had some moments, you know. And so yeah, both, you know, it's really not a franchise that has wowed me ever. You know, I think the moments in the first Exorcist movie are, you know, fairly iconic, certain things that have happened in it. And one of the biggest things that I feel like when I saw The Exorcist for the first time was, okay, cool, I've seen it. I've seen an Exorcist now. I've seen a really good version of it, and I thought it was fine. And there's no way to do that again. You know, someone's haunted, a priest comes in and says a load of shit, and then the demon does mad shit, and the demon then leaves the body. Like, that's kind of the blueprint, and there's not really a way to change it. And obviously, we'll come on to this movie, but like, that has been my thoughts on exorcism movies for the longest time, that you can't really change the blueprint. It's very formulaic, and you know, I think this one, you know, when we do get into it, does actually add some more interesting elements, but ultimately it does come down to that. So that's why I've never followed, you know, the sequels at length or any sort of spin-offs and stuff. I remember Exorcism of Emily Rose was quite good. Did you ever see that?
Yeah, back in the day, but I can barely remember anything about it.
No, I just remember it being quite good.
It was clearly ahead of its time in terms of, it was way before that, you know, the current lull that we're in terms of just this bombardment of these types of movies. But it is fascinating when you think about the original and how, like, this is a subgenre of horror, is possession movies. And that's a weird thing to think about, really, because it is more of like, you know, it's character and it's plot, and it's hard to think like, oh yeah, that's a subgenre, is someone getting possessed and them committing an exorcism on said individual to get rid of the curse. Like, that shouldn't be a subgenre in my eyes. Like you say, that is the plot of a film.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's weird to think that. I know that you could say something like similar with slashers, but it makes me think like, oh yeah, they didn't go, oh, a guy killing people in their dreams was so good, so that became its own subgenre. It's like, no, that's specifically one franchise that did that.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Like, someone stabbing someone, you know, a slasher is... It is very simplistic in the description, but it can be tweaked in so many ways. But yeah, I haven't really seen The Exorcist, you know, because even if you get to like Paranormal Activity, it's like, fundamentally it doesn't change. They've just added a second subgenre in.
Yeah.
You know, and the core plot doesn't change. But I guess, we touched upon, I think you can point a finger at people that don't like slashers would probably say that, but I just don't think it's as true, you know. And but I do think there is a, you know, there's a breadth of what you can do with it as opposed to these sorts of movies.
Yeah, I think as a subgenre it is very limited, because I think if you look at everything that's happened post Exorcist, I don't think it shies too far away from that. Whereas I do think if you look at slashers, I don't think every movie feels like Psycho, feels like Texas Chainsaw, feels like Halloween. I feel like there's so much variety there. Yeah, either way, there isn't any news this week, by the way. So good little preamble. The only thing I just put in my notes was that there's a nice sale going on at Arrow Video right now. So
yeah, there is.
If you want to spend all of your money like we have in the past week, just ahead of the lovely Hellraiser box set that's coming out in a couple of weeks, then you can do. So, yeah, happy days. All of our 4Ks will arrive shortly, and I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about when we've watched them all. Shall we talk about this week's film?
Let's do it.
Let's talk about The Exorcist Believer. So yeah, like we said before, this is the sixth installment in the Exorcist franchise. I feel like it's been a while. So what are we looking at? 2005. So a very long time ago. There was the beginning in 2004, and then Dominion.
Oh, Christ, I don't even remember.
There's a movie called Dominion Prequel to The Exorcist. Surely that can't be the full title.
I thought the beginning is part four, is it?
Hang on, I'm like just reading what this. One. I'm trying to find out if this Dominion is not like a documentary or something.
I thought the beginning was the fifth one, and then Believer was the sixth. But I mean,
Beginning's the fourth one because you had obviously the original. You had two Heretic, and you had Exorcist Three, which everyone likes. And then and then it was a while. It was 14 years, and then they did them in back to back years. So someone must have got hold of the license at that point.
Yeah, I don't know whether that one's like. Who knows?
No, well, yeah, we clearly don't. No. Because that is fascinating. Right off the bat, it's worth. This is a good time now that we're looking about the history of this because it was something that I discovered over the weekend. I think I might have heard this when we first talked about this movie, but it's so mind blowing that it's certainly worth talking about, especially in the context of like seeing the film. Is that Universal who bought the rights to The Exorcist to make this film? And obviously this is as part of a, you know, they want this to be a trilogy, obviously very much in the vein of the Halloween movies with a lot of the same behind the scenes people, which I'm sure we'll get to. They bought the rights for this. So this was a film that this entry cost like, I think it's $30 million, budget. You know, which is, I would say, is a fairly standard. Yeah, like decent size for like a big cinema horror. I'm sure that's very similar to the Halloween films. But do you know how much Universal paid just for the rights to The Exorcist? Because this is unbelievable when you think about it. It's purely just to, you know, call this an Exorcist movie. And obviously we can talk about just how many links and how almost little of The Exorcist there is in this film. And also, you know, this is a franchise that hasn't had an entry for nearly 20 years. Does it still have cachet in 2023? All these are valid questions. So you would think like, okay, what would be the value just to name the film The Exorcist? Yeah, well, Universal collaborated with Peacock and they paid $400 million for the rights to The Exorcist, which is, that's like easily 10x what I would have guessed. And is mind-blowing. That's like, to me, like, that's going to put you out of business how bad that call is, because there's no way on earth they're ever going to make that money back, ever. That's just crazy to me. That is so much higher than it should remotely be. Like, that's like a massive IP as a half, you know, just nearly half a bill.
Do you get the you know, do they own Exorcist 1 for that?
I would hope so. Like, I would really hope so.
You know what I mean? At least like any money that the Exorcist now makes, they get, you know, they don't just.
Yeah, it says distribution rights. So I would assume that means. Does that mean you get to put those old films on Peacock? Would be my assumption as well.
Let's be generous and say
they've now got the rights to those previous movies, which I'm sure there's only two, like say the people actually want to see being the first one and the third one. Let's say they're on Peacock. That's crazy. Like no ifs or buts about it. There isn't even like a, you could potentially justify it with certain stories. That is so past the realm of being a good deal, and something that is, I can't believe Universal would do that as well. Because that just seems crazy to me. Like, it's so mad. But yeah, this is the first one as part of that deal, like we said. And there's currently The Exorcist Deceiver, a sequel to this movie, scheduled for April 25. So about 18 months away. But yeah, I guess what is the plot of Believer, this newest entry?
Yeah, so for me, straight off the bat, this movie opens with a level of subtlety that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, same.
Where the movie starts with no one's possessed. No one's, you know, screaming into a camera, spinning their head around, you know, Vickers, you know, anything like that. We meet a couple on seemingly on holiday, who are kind of, one is heavily pregnant and kind of seeing the sights and walking around and goes to this blessing for her baby. And the other, the father, is this photographer that's taking all these pictures, and kind of we just see them kind of on holiday. And when the wife goes back to the hotel room to rest, a fairly major earthquake happens. And in the aftermath of the earthquake, we discover that the wife is has been crushed in the hotel rubble and kind of rushed to a hospital. And ultimately, the doctors can only save the mum or the child. And kind of we then cut to we see this decision being given to the father, and then we cut 13 years later, and we are rejoined with the dad with his now 13-year-old daughter as a single parent. And we his daughter, kind of Angela, is then kind of the crux of the movie. It's two girls, Angela and Catherine, then kind of take the lead. And, you know, we you know, don't have any hint of a possession or ghosts or anything. And we then kind of meet these two and see them go after school. One day they go off together into the woods, and Angela seemingly is trying to speak to her mother, and kind of Catherine has this, you know, idea that if you go to this certain place and you bring some possessions, you might get to talk to the dead, you know, as all kids know, you know, that place, right, you know, growing up. So they go there and they go missing, and kind of again this whole chunk, you know, there's not any spooky things really gone on. These two children are then missing for a big chunk of the movie. You know, they, when they eventually come back, we are what, 45 minutes into the movie probably. You know, and at this point they, you know, and so my kind of synopsis has gone longer than normal, because we're talking about a movie called The Exorcist, and it takes 45 minutes for that to remotely happen. Because yeah, when the girls do come back, they come back days later, but the girls think they've only been gone hours. They were 30 miles away from where they disappeared, and no recollection of what's gone on. And as they kind of go back home and start to try to get back to normal, they are both very not normal, and start to slowly show more and more signs of being possessed. And the movie kind of, you know, this is when the movie then starts to take the turn for the traditional, or more traditional, kind of exorcism and exorcist kind of style of things. You know, everything you saw of the two girls in the trailer looking a bit evil and doing weird shit happened an hour plus into this movie. Which I really was not expecting, like, going in. And in particular with, like, what we've seen in the past with kind of, you know, the people that made this movie and with the other franchises, it's like, oh, I wasn't expecting a level of subtlety where I was enjoying the movie that I was getting that wasn't an Exorcist movie. I was kind of, I liked the opening and found it interesting just to get the setup of the characters and the tragedy without there being spookiness. Just okay, yeah, we just witnessed this tragedy in their lives, and now 13 years later, here they are. I quite like their dynamic as a parent and daughter. And you know, his overprotectiveness, which he absolutely would have with what happened. And then kind of when the girls disappeared, I was like, oh, I really like this whole disappearance and what's going on. And, you know, these two parents that are clashing, but they need to, the parents, the two children clearly hate each other and blame the other person's daughter for what's happened, but they also know they have to work together to try to find them. And I kind of was enjoying all of that. And then when they kind of came back and they started to, the more we got to the point that, you know, they're going to be strapped in a chair and there's going to be a vicar, the more I was like, oh, yeah, I'm kind of zoning out a little bit more and more. Where I still enjoyed seeing the two girls in their lives starting to do stuff. The church scene that was in the trailer was enjoyable. Kind of Angela just kind of getting more and more kind of possessed was good. There, you know, there's a couple of jump scares that were reasonably effective for these sorts of things. And yeah, I was still fairly on board. But yeah, the closer you get to, oh, okay, this movie is called The Exorcist. The whole point of this movie is there is going to be an exorcism attempt, you know. So when is that going to happen? And as soon as it starts to happen, I was like, oh, yeah, now it's just what I was discussing earlier. You know, it is just, yeah, there's a person possessed, you know, screaming mad shit, tied down, holy water, a lot of biblical passages being read, and you know, it started to lose me. And when it got to the last kind of, you know, 5 or 10 minutes of it, and it was really amping up to the conclusion, I felt like visually it took a turn that was I think with The Exorcist, the original, something that I did like about it, and why I probably quite liked The Exorcism of Emily Rose a bit, was it felt quite grounded. And although she's like, her head is completely spinning around, it didn't feel like completely like just, you know, mystical, and that I'm, you know, have to dispend a lot of belief. And if it strapped it back a little bit further, that they weren't even going that far with it, it's like, oh yeah, like, you know, there are real stories of possession in the world and everything else. And it's like, okay, like, how close to realism, you know, quoted realism, can you get with these? Whereas with this movie, we got to the last 10 minutes and it almost became a scene out of fucking Nightmare on Elm Street, where there's like shit stuck to the ceiling and people upside down and just like really over the top stuff, and it kind of took me out of the more grounded exorcism that I wanted in my head. And yeah, you know, by the end of it, I didn't hate this movie. As far as like these sorts of movies and a cinema horror, like I found it like more enjoyable than not enjoyable. But when I start to look back at it, I'm like, yeah, I kind of enjoyed the stuff that wasn't a horror movie. You know, up until the girls went missing, came back, I was into the movie way more than the final acts. And certainly the exorcism itself, which is what you're paying to see when you go see a movie called The Exorcist, the exorcism was the least enjoyable part of the movie for me. So it's a weird situation to be, but I did still enjoy it. And like, even though we've said a lot how this subgenre it doesn't feel like you can reinvent the wheel, I thought having the two girls is this dynamic was something different. And the fact that when they were, together and they had these different things that were happening, and then things happening at the exact same time and stuff, it kind of you know, it was, I found it good, and especially with the dynamic of the two families and that, it did spice it up a bit. And just the fact that we didn't have like a screaming actual ghost in your face constantly, is like we get with a lot of these other movies that we see. It, even though this isn't a fresh idea, it felt just fresh to see normal people that are possessed as opposed to spooky ghosts screaming in nun outfits. So yeah, like I mostly enjoyed it. Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it?
Yeah, like I agree to some extent with what you said early on about I think it starts off strong. You know, it starts in a place that, yeah, I didn't see coming. The fact that this movie does spend so much time building up character and plot, I was like, oh shit, I really didn't expect that. You know, we talk a lot about the horror films kind of crowbarring in scenes of horror when they're not needed. You know, like Saw did it literally last week with this kind of dream sequence that felt so forced into the movie. And this movie didn't fall into that trap. You know, it just focused on telling a good story with these, with this father-daughter relationship and this kind of tragedy that happened. And it's really well done. And like, I was stunned because, yeah, for the first 30 minutes, I was learning more about these characters and I was really liking them, and was really surprised at how invested I was in it. And so I was kind of like, huh, this is weird. And I think the good thing was I had completely forgotten about the trailer at this point, yeah. Because I'd like forgotten that it was like, oh, this dual protagonist thing and stuff. So it wasn't until the girls went off into the woods that it then came rushing back to me. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's what this is about, sort of thing. So getting to that, I was enjoying it. And then, yeah, once they come back, I would say the first few scenes are good, where we just get the murmurs of like, oh, something might be up with these girls. Particularly like the scene when she's like brushing her teeth at night and stuff is probably like the best scene, probably for me, because it's the only scene of horror I think I enjoyed. Because after that, once it did become what you said, which is kind of the back half of the film being a more traditional possession stuff, I feel like it then just became the most sort of by the numbers generic possession movie possible, really. That it feel like it could have been just created by an AI, because nothing about this felt personal or original or interesting. Like, I found it to be such a snooze fest once it became a horror film, which was crazy, because like the drama that he made for 30 minutes I thought was really good, and the second he then needed to remember to make a horror film, all of those pitfalls came back and it was suddenly clear that he's incapable of making one, because I didn't enjoy any scenes of horror throughout this whole film, really. And I think it did get worse and worse the more we got into it, because it did become just so many tropes and so many like, oh, you remember The Exorcist, remember this bit. Even as someone who is like, I don't like The Exorcist, and I've seen it probably once properly years ago, and obviously I've seen like the clips a lot, so those iconic scenes and quotes are ingrained, but even I was like, oh, this is that shot from The Exorcist, that's that line from The Exorcist, and I couldn't imagine what it's like if you're like a super fan of this, whether it's annoying or, you know, like, is it so jarring because of how so painful it is aware of the past, or would you enjoy it? I don't know. Obviously that's not for me, but those things were crazy. I think when it becomes a horror film and it needs to remember it's a horror, that the way they treat legacy in this film, I thought was laughably bad. Arguably the most shitter scenes in the whole film all center around legacy characters, and just the way they crowbar it in, we're like an hour into the film and they're like, wait, this is an Exorcist film, oh shit, we need to reintroduce these characters and this family, felt painful. And that was the weirdest thing, is that this movie could have just been called Believer and it would have been $400 million cheaper, and that's what's crazy, is like, you could have just made your version of The Exorcist. It didn't need to be an Exorcist film. And I almost think that works more when you're doing such a strong homage, because that's what this is.
$400 million is a lot of money, though, bro.
Well, that's what I'm saying, though.
Yeah. But I think that's why, like, once they spend that money, they're like, shit, we've got to bring it in.
But yeah, but that's what's weird, is, like, you could have done your, you know, we're doing our modern take on The Exorcist. And I do think you can almost get away with the repeated lines and the kind of homages to the past. But when you're doing like the, you know, the light on the street and you're doing like all and like these direct quotes and stuff, it's very like, like say, oh, this is reminding us painfully of, like, do you remember that movie 50 years ago? And it's that's the thing that's really sad to me, is that it's like, oh yeah, remember that movie 50 years ago? Nothing has changed in this genre. Like, literally nothing. There's been nothing added in the last 50 years.
There's now two of them.
Exactly. And then that brings me on to another point, actually, because that was something that I was so excited for in the trailer. And that is almost pointless to me, because you have a lead character. Like, I forgot that at one point there was another person possessed, because it is such a singular story, which is centered on two very good characters, these father and daughter, which I think are excellent and deserved such a better movie than this. Like, the performances of these two characters were just phenomenal, truly. And it's like we keep saying before, it's just something that we just take for granted. But, like, Leslie, who plays the father, is, like, incredible. He's just so good in every scene. And I really believed, like, his pain as a parent and everything. He's just so good. And it's just in a film that just deserves so much. He deserves so much better, because it's all for nothing. You know, once we get to the horror, once we get to, like, the, oh, they're possessed, whatever shall we do? There's no stakes. I didn't care about anything that was happening. It was a complete snooze fest. And then we get this kind of, you know, not to spoil anything, but it's such, like, a shitty writing moment of this kind of, like, choice that's involved, that is kind of, like, crowbarred in at the start in a weird way, and then comes back in the finale in a super unsatisfying way. That's just like, wait, what is this film now? Why is this a thing? So that was really just annoying, and just really took it away from me, because I really wanted it to be about these two families coming together to save their children, and it's really not that. It is just like, oh, she happened to have a friend who also got possessed, and so there's that one cool scene in the church, because that's pretty much all she does on her own. Like, aside from that one scene, she's pretty much just the side character to our lead throughout the rest of the film. So yeah, this is a weird one, because I think, like, the craft of it, certainly as a drama, shocked me how good it was. And I certainly wasn't expecting it based upon his last two movies, where, like, I thought the overall craft was abysmal. And so I was like, oh, he's got, like, good story here and good characters and stuff. But then, yeah, once it became a horror film, I was painfully reminded of the pitfalls. And it made me just think, like, he just doesn't want to make horror films. And I don't know why he is, because he didn't for a very long time. And I don't know how he's done this. Like, it feels like the biggest swindle of the century, that he's, like, somehow wormed his way into this genre. I would love to know those, like, early conversations of when they got their hands on Halloween, because it's just crazy. Let alone, this is way crazier. Because he might have had a fairly decent idea. And like I say, I'm not going to rewrite history and pretend that I didn't think Halloween 2018 was good, because I do think it's a good film. And it's certainly his best film out of these four. But I can't believe that he would then, you know, off the back of the last two, and especially the last one, which was pretty much universally panned, to then kind of get Universal to give him the keys to the kingdom in a way that I don't think this has ever happened in the history of the genre, is that a company has gone out, spent the money that they've spent, and backed him with a new trilogy. I mean, this is completely unprecedented. If this happened to someone like a Mike Flanagan, you'd be like, oh yeah, he's earned that through what he's done over the last decade, or even a Jordan Peele or someone. But this is crazy to me that this has happened, and seeing the reactions to this, like, there's already there's some trepidation about whether or not they're going to can this trilogy, and there's already talks about, oh well, he didn't actually say he was going to direct the next one, so I'm very curious to see sort of how this is going to shake out, because yeah, it's not been well received, it's not made a lot of money, and it's just crazy when you do these bold decisions. Like, we've seen this even with stuff like Star Wars, when you plan this far ahead. Like, Marvel's one of the few that's able to pull it off. Like, DC shot themselves in the foot with it as well. And the horror world needs to not get too big for its boots. Spending $500 million and planning out trilogies ahead is not what the horror genre should be doing at all. There's not a single franchise that in the history of horror that deserves that sort of treatment. There just isn't. Just make good films.
I think that's the thing, is, like, what IP in horror should get that sort of treatment? And the answer is none.
No.
you know,
Fans make a Nightmare on Elm Street trilogy and it cost them $500 million to make it, I'd still go, that's insane. Like, do not do that.
Crazy. Like, I would love it, but they absolutely shouldn't do it. But I would love it if they did. Because, it's like, you know, we've spoken at length about how much we want Nightmare on Elm Street IP to be back and give it to a filmmaker and let's bring Freddy back, you know. But it's like, Jesus Christ, whoever owns Freddy and they look at The Exorcist selling for $400 million, they're like, well, that's Freddy Krueger IP is never going to get sold.
Oh yeah, we're never seeing that or Friday or any of these things now, because like I say, this has broke the market now.
Yeah, because it's like, well, if The Exorcist is worth $400 million, what the fuck is Nightmare on Elm Street worth?
Yeah, I'll tell you, more is the answer.
Yeah, but then, you know, look at what Star Wars was brought for.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Well,
this is so asinine that hopefully it will just be ignored and written off, because if you try and use this as any sort of common denominator going forward, it breaks all math. Like, it
add up. We saw this with video games where, like, a company that made a free app that blew up then sold for billions.
Yeah.
And it was like, they sold for more than Star Wars. And it was like, what? Yeah. It's one app. This company makes a free app that with in-app purchases that has a finite life. Mm. And it's just been sold for more than Star Wars. That is infinite money forever, because Star Wars will never cease to be a thing, you know? It's mad, but I think Legacy was something that I did want to touch upon.
What did you think of them?
Yeah, I thought it was awful. Like it was the worst part of the movie. You know, it's basically when the dad jumps to instantly. Luckily, he's got a neighbor that's a religious person that knows all about exorcists that also works in the hospital. Like, fuck, that's convenient, isn't it? Like, mad convenient. My neighbors are useless. They would bring jack shit to the table, like, ever.
Every connection that you could possibly want in this film.
Yeah. And but you know, so he is aware that you know, he thinks she is now possessed, so he does the usual. Let's find a YouTube clip and let's see the legacy characters there, and then let's go visit them. And it's in this, it's this terrible scene where he rocks up to a door, doesn't knock on it, and she's just staring at him through a window. Like, it was the most awkward thing I've ever seen in my life. I'm like, dude, knock on the door. An old lady stops staring out the window at guests, like, go answer the door. And then they have this real awkward exchange. Then she comes and there's just, you know, a really awkward scene with her, like, where she's like, well, I don't perform exorcists, but I just know a lot about them. And I'm like, well, what the fuck are you doing here then? Like, you know, and then she's just AWOL then for a chunk of the movie, but keeps being cut to, only to, you know, come back towards the end in some way. And it's like, you know, not to give spoilers or anything, but I got like a little bit of a pop in the end bit, like a slight little pop. And like, I wonder if you're a huge fan, you know, are you do you pop for that? Are you happy? Are you upset? You know, how do you feel as a big fan? Not you, but how does a big fan feel like seeing it? Because, you know, I would be fascinated. You know, like we say, we're not in love with this franchise. We don't, you know, seeing the spotlight to me doesn't, you know, move the needle. The song, you know, we have the variations of the Exorcist theme throughout this movie, and, you know, then eventually we got it close. I don't think we ever got it like in its absolute like original form, did we? I think it always was it was like an 80% variant towards the end, and it started off with like a 10% variant. And it's like, throughout the movie, I like that theme. I think it's a great, you know, the original theme is iconic, and I like it. And so throughout this movie, I liked hearing it and hearing it come a bit more and more, but like it, you know, I can't talk to a level of fandom for it.
Yeah, that was one thing we were both nervous about because of the trailer, which is funny because we both liked the trailer in terms of it looking like a good horror film, which turned out to be false. But then we were both worried about, oh, this overuse of the theme, which I don't think was a problem in the finale, in the final product at all. Like, I think the music was done well. And it wasn't like this, oh, you know, remember this theme, we're going to constantly edge it with it throughout the whole film. Like, I don't think they've done that, which was good. But yeah, talking about those legacy, like, I did do a bit of research because I was curious what you just said as well. Like, okay, what are people that are fans of this thinking about this? People aren't happy, like, especially with Chris, because the way she's portrayed in this film is kind of not apparently in line with what she would have been as a character at all. And even from my perspective, looking at, you know, returning, getting Ellen Burstyn to return, you know, she was nominated for an Oscar for this film, for The Exorcist. And, like, that is an all-time legendary performance, and it's sad because, yeah, she, much like you continually see, you know, I think about Linda Hamilton and that recent Terminator piece of shit and stuff, and it's just like, it's so sad when you bring back these people that entertained people in such a pivotal way that it's still being remembered and talked about 50 years later. And that's what they should be remembered for. They shouldn't be remembered for these other, you know, coming back to the franchise, doing their best job, and it's just in such a terrible film. Because no. Yeah, that's the only thing I can compare it to, because that's something that I'm, you know, we're both strongly about as Terminator, and it very much feels like that. Of, I remember when I was watching that film, I was like, God, Linda Hamilton's so good, and this film is so bad.
I don't know what to do right now. Like, you've brought up Terminator, and I want to move on to I know, but I want to move on to a different point. But now I want to dissect Terminator a little bit more.
My brain hurts. The film, then go for it. But because I think it's valid here. Like, you know,
that's well, no, I was things. Actually, in all seriousness, I was thinking about Neve Campbell and, like, you know, how, you know, she has left the franchise, you know, and left the franchise because she was, obviously it wasn't the reason, or it wasn't, you know, the only reason, but her character was at risk of becoming what these are, where she gets 10 minutes worth of screen time and it becomes this just shell of what Sydney was, you know.
We saw Courtney Cox in that film.
Yeah, but I think it could be worse than that.
I think it would have been,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, like, the Courtney Cox wasn't... It
always has a reason because of her job, whereas...
Yeah, and, like, and her level of pettishness. Like, yeah. she can never get away from Joseph.
Yeah, whereas, like Sydney has no reason to be in that film.
Yeah, she has no agenda to get involved with Ghostface these days. She wants to fuck off and be happy, and that makes me happy. Whereas, yeah, Gale doesn't, and you know... And I think just doing that with these legacy characters, knowing when to not pull the trigger. And I just think with this one, for me, and again, you know, the 400 million, you're right. If this movie was just called The Believer, you know, it would have been a cool exorcism movie. But the second you spend 400 million on an IP to put the name Exorcist in there, you kind of then have to, like, try to do some other shit. And it does, you know, I think it is a shame that they were in there, because I felt dissatisfied with seeing her, and like I say, until that, though, you know, the little bit at the end, I did get a little bit of a, like, ah, cool, you know, but that was all it was. It wasn't like a holy fucking shit, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like you said, if you get one of these characters return and you kind of get this huge brilliant moment, you know, imagine if there's, like, a Terminator movie and Sarah Connor comes back right at the very end and does some ball of shit, you'd be like, holy fucking shit, you know, instead of what we got. And, you know, like, this, if this had been a really cool big moment in the movie, it could have really felt special. And in the end, it was like, oh, cool, yeah, you threw a shit ton of money at this, and yeah, did that, okay, sweet. Yeah, it is weird, but ultimately the rest of the movie, I didn't have a bad time with it. Everything apart from exorcisms I quite liked.
So does that mean, like, did you like any of the horror? Because I know that's kind of like they're hand in hand, so it's hard to kind of split them up, because I didn't find anything in this that worked as a horror film.
I mean, pretty much on page with you. Like, I think I did enjoy, like, the bathroom scene was really good. I loved when, like, within a second she was behind him, and it was it was almost like funny,
but
scary as well, and just like fucked up. And I did like that. I did enjoy the church scene, for what it was.
What about the last 30 minutes?
No. So I think they bottled the church scene.
Yeah, though, I did as well. Because, there's gonna be more on that.
Yeah, and I think they could have gone further with certain parts of it. And
yeah, I couldn't believe how quickly that was over.
Yeah. But yeah, the second the two girls are strapped to a chair, nothing then. It didn't move the needle at all for me. And like I said, when it got to those last 10 minutes and it started to get nonsense, in my opinion, when you've got, like, you know, just spewing blood onto the ceiling and it's creating this weird, like, vortex look. And then, you know, and you just got all this stuff that just, it just felt very over the top.
I liked when there was like someone's essence as like a smoke battling this other entity in a smoke form as well. That was a really good scene.
Yeah, exactly. It just became, and like, are you with me, like, as someone that doesn't overly like this subgenre anyway, but like, I like it when it's more grounded in perceived realisticness. I don't know what the correct term is, because I don't think it is realism, but do you know what I mean, where it's more grounded.
Yeah, like, I can do, I think in general I would, but I do think it can work, because, like, one thing I was thinking when I was watching this just ludicrous finale was like, oh, this feels like every Insidious sequel. And I think that ultimately Insidious 1 did that stuff well. So you can do that and it be very over the top, but it still be good and fun, a horror film. Whereas I do think, once you're getting to these wacky scenarios, like, it felt like every Conjuring spin-off and every... I couldn't believe how much it felt like an Insidious film, when you're going to this, like, other place, and there's, like, this battle between darkness and good, and then there's, like, this super artificial choice as well. I feel like that's such an Insidious trope as well, forced in there, of, like, well, someone has to pay the price for this, to, you know, for us to survive this. It's never, like, everyone just gets out.
I don't know whether we want to go into spoiler or not, because I think I can talk about it without spoiler. But the choice, I really did find, like, very unsatisfying. I found it to be very obvious what was going to happen, and just not clever. You know, when it kind of happened, and I was like, okay, I think this is what's going to happen. But I'm like, what's going to be the cool, like, twist? You know, what are they going to do that's clever? And ultimately they just kind of went meh, you know, and just didn't even try to do anything. And it was just I found it quite when we got to, like, the happy minute of the end of the movie, or, you know, not the happy, because it's, but, you know, the little kind of, like, recap video of everyone, like, post Exorcist, I was like, I was just waiting for, like, something to happen where it was like, is this actually happening? It doesn't feel like this is happening. This feels like a dreamlike state where I was like, this doesn't really feel like this is how the exorcism ended. It feels unsatisfactory. It did leave me feeling a bit confused. I didn't enjoy that, the finale / decision at all.
Yeah, I hated it. Like, as soon as it was something that they brought up, I was like, oh, please, God, no, let it be this. And once it was, I found it to be, generic and boring, and also really, like, distasteful. And it also, even though I don't remotely want to see a sequel to this terrible film, but, like, it makes me way less excited for a sequel with the way they ended it. You know, because I think there would have been grounds there for, you know, certain characters getting through this and then seeing how they would interact with one another and confide in one another and talk about their experiences and what they went through. And so for them to do what they did, I was just like, man, he's done the classic thing of, like, this is a trilogy, but I can tell you've not at one point ever thought about the next two films. It's that classic. I mean, he's really a radical filmmaker, because I've never seen another guy that makes trilogies in the same way of, like, he doesn't even put a second of thought into what could possibly be in the next movie.
There's not a second of world building.
That's impressive.
It's the opposite of world building.
Yeah, I don't know how that's possible. How can you not even for a half a second just think, like, oh, but what if this happens in the sequel? It's like his brain just doesn't let him do it, because he's so focused on making the film.
It's like, imagine building a house and you build a house and you build a bungalow and you put a roof on, And then you go, I'm going to put another floor on now. So I need to knock the roof off, put some stairs in somewhere, and then build the next floor. And then you put a fucking roof on it again. And then you go, nah, I probably want three-story. You know, and that's how he makes
films. That's perfect. That is, spot on. That is exactly how he makes film trilogies. Yeah.
It's mad. You know, and then suddenly he's like, fuck, I need some windows in this bitch. Like, and it's
just, roof's coming off again.
Yeah. I've got the roof off now. Like, oh, you're going to put water into a house? Like, shit, I need to dig it up and fuck it. I'm like, yeah, but you're in the fourth film now, mate. Like, you can't just, you know. And he's like, yeah, but my, you know, I honestly, I think it's going to get to a point where he's going to be like, do you know what? The second movie in my film series doesn't count anymore. I'm deleting that, because he's already come along and deletes like multiple movies in the franchises before.
Yeah.
So he's gonna get to the, you know, the Exorcist 4 in his quadrilogy.
Oh, and I'd love, like, that. Yeah, one of my films isn't canon. Yeah. That'd be so good. Yeah.
And then he's like, you know what? Exorcist 2, Exorcist Believer 2 isn't canon anymore.
That's genius. See, that's a great idea.
It's gonna happen.
Yeah.
Like, at some point in his career, if he gets to continue to make these movies, which is at least coming into doubt.
It's very in doubt after this film. I just pray,
because he's not got an IP that hurts us.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I was just going to say. Yeah. I pray that he's, because he's obviously got, he's supposedly doing this Hellraiser HBO show. And like, the idea of the Hellraiser show on HBO is like my dream come true. And he is the worst man in the world that could be involved in that for me personally. There's a quote here. I want to end on this, or at least mention it, because this was my favorite thing I saw over the weekend. So I was looking up about the previous, obviously, the director of the original, William Friedkin, who sadly passed away earlier this year. But he was an amazing for a quote back in the day, because when he was talking about, you know, sequels to his films in general, he said that he would never watch them because it would depress him to do so. And he said, I wasn't involved in any of the Exorcist sequels or the French Connection sequel. Not only was I not involved, I haven't seen them. I view them as shit. Which is an amazing quote. They were simply made to cash in on the title. The public isn't stupid. They can see a ripoff when it's coming. So he already said that. Then, he wasn't involved in this movie at all. Obviously, he then sadly passed away earlier this year. And in a Q&A recently, David speculated on what he would think about the film. And said, I was looking forward to showing him the film because I never communicated with him. My understanding was that he didn't want involvement in the actual film production, but he'd be happy to give his thoughts after the film was done. So very much sort of living in his own world there, which is already kind of a crazy thing to say. But then this is the best thing I've read for so long. So a writer and film critic, Ed Whitfield, took to Twitter to tell a story about a conversation he'd had with William before his passing, who said, William Friedkin once said to me, Ed, the guy who made these new Halloween films is about to make one to my movie, The Exorcist. That's right. My signature film is about to be extended by the man who made Pineapple Express. I don't want to be around when that happens. But if there's a spirit world and I come back, I plan to possess David Gordon Green and make his life a living hell.
Fucking hell.
That is the best thing I've ever read. William Friedkin is now my new favorite director. And I'm going to spend the next week watching every single one of his films, because I don't think I can love someone more after reading that. It's just perfect, isn't it?
I'm going to watch The Exorcist again.
I know. I'm going to watch everything he's ever done. Absolutely love him.
This one as well, like, obviously it's, you know, sad he's passed away. I mean, he was in his late 80s, I believe, when he passed away.
Yeah, or still he might have been 90, but yeah.
And, but, like, reading that quote, it is almost like he died in spite of this movie. Just like, nah, fuck it. I refuse.
Yeah.
There's no point. Like, do you know what? I've had a good innings. Like, see you in the afterlife. Like, from that.
Oh, he directed Killer Joe.
Did he?
Yeah, I love that film. Nice. I might watch that this week. But yeah, that was amazing. Like, I think that's the best way to end it, really. Like, it's a great man.
We can't sum it up better than what William just did.
No, and love the fact that him, you know, he's passed, yet his stories and quotes are still giving me more enjoyment than David's films ever will. Thank you for that. And fuck David Gordon Green. But yeah, that was our discussion of The Exorcist Believer. We'll take a quick break and we will be right back. So yeah, we're back after that fun chat about a film. Shall we talk about some TV?
Shall we?
Yeah, I mean, there's a return. No, I mean, we're just living in franchise horror right now. Because sometimes some franchises live on in different forms, and one of our all-time favorites is living on via the television.
Yeah, in a form, clinging on to that canon.
Yeah, clinging on to dear life, really. Yeah, kind of canon, kind of still alive, kind of half a season. Don't know if anyone's still watching this other than us at this point.
I genuinely don't think, I don't think so. I think, like, we could just phone up Don and be like, do you want to come round and watch Chucky with us? He'd be like, yeah, sweet, Jennifer won't watch it with me anymore.
Yeah, it's insane. But yeah, season 3 premiere, episode 1. Of course, mm-hmm. as always with our TV, we just do full spoilers. So we're going to be spoiling the shit out of episode 1. But what did you make about the return of Chucky?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Like, just seeing the little bastard on screen just makes me happy. Do you know what I mean? Like, just as soon as I see the good guy doll, I'm happy. Mm. I think, like, it was good. It's one where as always with Chucky, there's quite a bit to unpack. How many times are we gonna have people come back from the dead playing different people in this series? It's kind of hilarious. Like, are we just Devin Sawyer's just president now, right?
Yeah, like, it's funny to have one guy do that, because I think that's been his thing, you know. He obviously did that last season, and so it was like, and I knew he was in this in some capacity, so, you know, I'm fine with having him be the kind of weird shapeshifter, but there is other characters that have, you know, his little second-in-command was in the previous season. I can't remember, was he the dad or was he the psychologist? I can't remember exactly who he was.
I know, but it is weird where, like, seasons of Chucky are kind of becoming like seasons of American Horror Story.
Yeah,
but it's trying to still be canon. or is it that it just isn't, and it's just you and me that are trying to keep it canon?
Well, I do question that sometimes, especially after episodes like this, because there was so much happened in the finale of the last season, and I was like desperate to find out, and we got not a single answer to anything.
No, I know, but like, that's gonna be the mid-season break, like, you know.
Oh, don't tell me that,
because obviously, like, Lexi is actively trying to find her sister,
yeah,
which is the thread of the finale of the last season.
Yeah, so that makes sense. Like, the, you know, what the teens were doing made perfect sense. It was just a shame that they were barely in it.
It is weird though, because I did enjoy the fact that the teens were like doing their thing, and then like Chucky is just in this mad scenario, just kind of doing Chucky stuff. Because ultimately, like, now when he's with the three teens, they know his shtick, and he can't just kill them instantly. They can't just kill him instantly, and they all know his shtick. So them being together isn't that appealing to me, because it's what can you do with it, you know? Whereas the fact that Chucky is just in this brand new scenario and he can just kill people and do his thing, and like the fact that it's in the White House is just amusing, is fun. And also it's funny that, like, the end of this episode, the kids know where he is, but it's like, well, how the fuck do they break into the White House? Like, you know, Chucky's just going to be like in the Oval Office out the window, like giving him the middle finger, and they're not going to be able to do anything. Like, you know, they're going to get arrested in the next episode trying to break in. Like, they're not going to be able to break into the White House, and it's kind of genius. And so I do like that as well. Like, you know, the setup of this versus season two, like, I'm more on board with this than the kind of weird school that they were in, because I do think, you know, and the fact that they have seemingly scaled it back to, you know, I can't even remember at the end of the last season how many dolls and who's a doll and who's not, and you know, Tiff and the others and everything else. But like, have we only got one Chucky doll at this point, as we know, as far as we know?
I don't. It's difficult because yeah, it's really difficult. Yeah. We I feel like we mainly did have one that was with the little girl.
Yeah.
And then, but I it's like, is that the same one? Because, like I say, there is a lot here that, that is unanswered. We get, like I say, we get the teens. We don't get much of them, but they are doing what you'd expect of, like, trying to get on with their lives, trying to live. And I liked all that stuff and them kind of, you know, moving forward. But then they are trying to find her sister. So all that made sense. I just wish there was more of them. And then we are just plonked in a brand new scenario, of course, which is fine. You know, they always switch up the settings for the seasons. I liked an initial reveal when it pulled back and it was the White House, because I was like, oh, that's hilarious, and like, didn't see it coming. Yeah. But then I think by the end of this episode, I'm already getting a bit kind of like sick of the shtick, because I'm like, I don't really know what else they could do with this. Like, I think a lot of the agents and the suits aren't that interesting, which is fine, because I'm sure they're mostly just going to be like cannon fodder. But I didn't find him to be that interesting. I thought the one kill was really weak as well. The fact that he didn't really speak, he just kind of pulled a trigger on a gun, and it was just not weak in terms of visually, because it looked great, but it was over so quickly. And there wasn't like any cool one-liners. Like, I thought there was just a lack of Chucky talking in this one. In general, there's a lot of just shots of him motionless, which is obviously, again, makes sense early on, because he's staying incognito. So yeah, I didn't love it. I was probably saying mildly disappointed, just because I was so excited to see the continuation of, you know, what's going on with Andy. And it obviously, it's very notable for me when Fiona and Jennifer aren't in an episode. Yeah. And for me, those are always the weakest ones. Like, that's just a preference. Like, I much prefer when they're in it. To me, they're my two favorite characters. And so I love it when they're on screen, and when they're not in it, I'm just waiting for them to be there. So to have a whole, you know, 40 odd minute episode with them not in it, I even like a little tease of them at some point would have done it for me. So just to have them not be there at all, it was rougher for me.
It's weird, because I kind of expected it. So I
yeah, we had it before, didn't we, in season one?
Yeah, like, and season two. Like, it wasn't instant, I don't think. I don't know whether they were in the first episode, but...
Yeah, I can't remember.
Because they're, like, fucking around in the hotel room, aren't they, in season two?
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, I don't know. Like, for me, I would have been, like, absolutely floored if they'd have been in this episode, so it just kind of didn't surprise me that they weren't. And I do think, for me, the thing that I definitely do love them the most, because obviously, yeah, we, you know, we've talked at length about how much we love this and love the story and the craziness that's going on, and like, I don't even know where they're at this point. I'm like, I don't know what limbs Fiona has, and I don't know whether Jennifer's in Tiff and Tiff's in Jennifer, and what's I can't even remember.
Yeah, it's like, hard.
At this point, what dolls are still around? Are the children dolls? Are they doll children? Like, I just can't even remember. I do feel like I need to watch the season two finale again, because right now I haven't lost anything, because this first episode didn't continue that. But when it does, I want to be primed.
Yeah.
But yeah, the thing that I like next is Chucky being Chucky, and that does involve him not always talking, people not being aware that he's a killer doll. I don't enjoy Chucky when people know he's a killer doll.
Yeah,
because it, you know, it becomes less exciting. So like with the guards and stuff, and when they're kind of looking around for a disturbance, and you see the doll sat in the middle of the room, but clearly a guard at the White House is not going to be looking at a doll. You know, he's looking around the room for a threat, and just clocks this little doll and thinks, well, that's a doll, like, fine. And like, and I enjoy that like dynamic and seeing it, and I don't know whether I'll ever get bored of it. And so I do like that side of it. I do agree that like once he breaks character and becomes active, it would have been better if he was active for longer. But I still enjoyed that kill, and enjoyed kind of seeing Chucky be the incognito Chucky throughout this episode.
Yeah.
You know, I do think we should get to a point that Chucky becomes post-apocalyptic.
Mm.
You know, he's in the Oval Office. Like, he needs to press the big red button. Like, and just, you know, ensue chaos.
Well, it's season three of a horror show that's probably not going to have a season four. So
there you go. There you go.
Why not end it with a season that you wouldn't possibly be able to afford? So yeah, maybe that is where they're going with it. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it more. Like I say, we've still got a few more episodes to look forward to. So hopefully we'll get some of those legacy characters return. And I'm really curious, like, if we're going to get any mention or anything of Glenn and Glenda. Because they were awesome last season, and I was disappointed with how it ended anyway, because it was very much like, oh, it's cool to see that doll again, but them kind of like combining and going just back in the doll and then that being shipped off to England, it was very much like, are we ever gonna see this? Which I don't think we will, because I don't know how that possibly make any sense.
It just felt like a finite, it felt like he was told you have 3 episodes with them. I remember I popped so hard when they rocked up at TIFFs.
Yeah,
like, well, it is one where, like,
there was so much good shit, like that stuff specifically was really good. Yeah, in the last season.
I know, that's why, like, my memory of season 2 is a bit of a downer. And then when I keep thinking about moments in season 2, I'm like, man, we had some real crazy stuff.
Yeah, there was some awesome moments. The final episode was really good as well.
Yeah, and the Jennifer Tilly, This Is Your Life episode was just amazing.
Yeah.
You know, there really was. But yeah, I'm glad that, like, I'm just actively looking forward to Chucky again. Like, it really is a treat, and it's one that, with Ash vs. Evil Dead, we didn't let it pass us by without just absorbing what a gift it was, and I'm continuing to do this with Chucky.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, the only other thing I was going to touch on while we're talking TV, I think you've spoke about it before, is I watched all of Twisted Metal.
Oh, yeah, nice.
And, yeah, I found it a really enjoyable, just fun TV show. You know, I think you said, you know, it's not strong horror, but it's got quite a lot of violence in it. And just each episode was just this dumb road trip. It had a really great tone of being comedic, but also kind of being in this world and just being dumb and just having fun and being like, oh, okay, I want to do this cool thing this episode. I'm just going to do it, like, because it's fun. And I had a really good time with it. And I think it, like, it feels like it was quite underrated and just kind of passed people by. And I do think it is worth people who like horror movies and like, you know, just fun, violent action, like, slash, you know, not really, you know, I wouldn't call it horror, but definitely over the top violent action. This was just a really fun TV show for me. It had a satisfying ending, or, you know, it had, I felt like it got, the ending happened and I was like, man, I really want to watch season 2 now. Like,
yeah. I kind of
wish that it had have ended in a way that was more like, let's just tie a bow in this because we're not quite sure. Because it actually ended in a place where I'm like, damn, I'm more excited to see that than I was any prior episode if you'd have ended the season.
Definitely. That was, like, you know, for me, the biggest issue. I really liked the show, but I thought the middle dragged. And I think getting to the finale took too long. And then the finale was cool, but it was over too quick because it was compacted in half an episode. And then they built to a potential future where it was like, this is the real Twisted Metal TV show that we wanted, because that's actually what Twisted Metal is as a franchise, which we didn't get in this whole season. So it is like, oh, I hope that it does well enough. Because, yeah, I thought it was... It's a fun comedy show, and I think that we live in an era of so much, like, heightened stuff, you know, like, post The Last of Us and stuff. Art. Yeah, where it's okay to just have something that's fun, because that word gets, you know, too much pushed down and like, oh, it was just fun. And that was genuinely how I'll describe that show, is that it was fun. Like, I enjoyed my time. The episodes were so short and palatable, and each one always had a couple of moments that made me smile or made me laugh or had genuine fun character interactions. Like, I think the two core characters were brilliant, and I really liked Sweet Tooth as well. So it had, like, 3 really cool characters in it. So, yeah, I liked it, and I really hope that we get a season 2. I wish it had a bigger budget, because that was the thing that really... The car combat was limited finale, because of the budget.
The finale was very budget restrained. You know, it really felt like they had hired this track out for half a day and had, you know, two or three cars that they could blow up and that was it.
Yeah, that's why they were like, oh, this season two would be great, but we need 10x our current budget.
Yeah, I was going to say that they pulled the Ash versus Evil Dead trigger straight away.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, they used their budget in this season. And then, yeah, that was almost like their plea to the network. Like, if you want us back, this is what we actually want to make. This feels like a prequel. But it was very enjoyable.
It's almost like a pilot, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, like, you put... because, you know, it was, what, 10 episodes, but each episode, you know, probably 3 episodes makes up a normal TV show.
Yeah, they're so short.
They were so small. But yeah, like, I really enjoyed it. I love Sweet Tooth.
Yeah.
Sweet Tooth was brilliant. Like, his whole shtick of trying to put on a show and making people like him and just, you know, I don't think there was anything that he said that didn't land in the whole season.
So, their like attention to detail as well in terms of the characters and the Easter eggs from the games is insane. Like, it's every character in that and every car is from, you know, some sort of entry within that universe. And it's like, it's crazy that they made all of that work where, you know, I'm not hugely familiar. I've replayed the first 2 games. 2%
of them landed on me.
Yeah, like, I, you know, like, his paper bag, like, that's the original ending. You know, if you beat the game as Sweet Tooth, that's his prize, is the paper bag. And so the fact that it's just this random low-res cutscene in the original game, they ended up making, you know, a really funny character in this show. And that's, yeah, that's littered throughout, like, the botanist character and the old lady character who's, like, sex-crazed. Like, all of this stuff comes from the game, and it's just, it's mad. I really wish that there was a new modern game to play as well, because Twisted Metal is such a cool, interesting, unique IP that definitely should live on.
And it is fun, like you said, people taking a video game IP and doing something like this with it in a year that Last of Us came out, because not everything can be Last of Us.
No.
If only it could, but also I'm glad it's not, because my brain couldn't take that.
Yeah,
you know, and
there's only about 3 other stories ever in video games that are even close to The Last of Us.
Well, there's that as well, but yeah, but like, even if you don't, you know, like this is them building on stuff, building on scraps, and giving you this story arc from a cutscene from the original game and this sort of thing. And it's like, yeah, you know, clearly the people that made this franchise really love the games, but they also just made a cool story. Like, this is cool post-apocalyptic. If this was called, you know, Mad Max season 1, you'd be like, okay, yeah, all right, I know that IP. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was just a fun story in this weird post-apocalyptic world where you have these drivers doing these things.
Yeah.
You know, I love the whole lorry convoy.
They're
just on the road constantly in this community living inside these lorries. I loved that. I thought it was great. And
yeah,
the botanist was great. The kind of, these different cults that you see, and the one when they were all wearing the bags on their head and then kind of they infiltrated them, and just like so many funny moments in that episode, because that cult were just useless. and like, it was just so funny when he was like, can we hang him up on the stake, and someone else was already on there, and he's like, come on guys, when the body's dead, take it down.
Yeah.
Like, you've just ruined my mojo now, because we've got to take that body down and it's going to be too late to put this one up. And I was like, oh, it's just so funny. Like, it really just, it landed. The humor really did land with me.
Yeah, I think it's from some of the guys that did Deadpool, which makes perfect sense. Yeah, because it's very much that style of humor, for sure.
Yeah, I thought it was a really fun season.
Yeah, it was really good. I did watch one thing, which I'll just briefly touch upon, because it's something that we have talked about on the show. But I did finally get around to rewatching Lola in the past week.
Let's not just touch upon it briefly.
Because, I bought the Blu-ray as soon as it came out, and then I've only just got around to watching it. But yeah, it was a joy. Like, it was... I love how just weird and unique that film is. To the point where I don't think it's some like hugely rewatchable film, which is perfectly fine. And it's something that I actually gravitate more towards, nowadays. I used to be someone that would rewatch a lot of stuff, but I feel like in the last 5 years, there's only really been one or two films that have really broke that mold of something like Psycho Goreman that really just broke me, that I ended up watching so many times. Whereas other than that, I'm more than happy to watch something and love it and just move on, and maybe rewatch it in a few years' time. And it's something like this that now I've seen it again, like, I don't know when I'll be in the mood for it again. But it's so cool. Like, it's instantly reminds me of Bioshock Infinite so much. Like, it's crazy, the whole I always love that trope, and I know it's kind of most famous in Back to the Future, but I love that when you take a song and put it in a different time period, there's something that's so uncanny and weird about that, of like, oh, this piece of art shouldn't exist in the current narrative of where we're at in the universe. And I love that as an art form and as a concept. It's one of those like weird, really underutilized time travel techniques. If you want to make things feel weird and a bit off, it's like, yeah, you can do the classic, like, oh yeah, you're changing shit. Mm-hmm. But just taking a film, like a song, is so receptive of the era that it was made in. And so if you take like a song from the 70s and put it in the 40s, it feels like it's from another planet. And yeah, I love that, especially at that time as well, because yeah, there just wasn't anything like that. So having that as kind of like a setup and as a, I forgot that the kind of the music changing is something that's so pivotal in the film, really, you know, like how much they changed the world, you know, for the worse, ultimately, and stuff. It's really, really good. Like, it's, the movie's like amazing. And then I think it's a bit slow towards the end would be like my only criticism. I think for the most part, it's amazing, but it gets to the point where they change so much and they ultimately stop using Lola as much. And then I'm just kind of waiting for it to end in a really awesome way. Like, I love like the last sort of 10 minutes, but there is like a probably 10 to 15 minute spell where I'm like, okay, I need to get to that point. Cause it's just showing the same stuff over and over, but it's still amazing.
It almost got too big. Too big with the stuff that was happening on screen, and it was almost like the subtlety of it that was playing on my mind. You know, when they're just like, David Bowie isn't around anymore.
Yeah,
you know, like, I'm like, holy shit, you deleted Bowie. Like, you know, like, doing stuff like that is like you say, just the, you know, movies and music not happening because you've said something, you know, you've said a line from, you know, Titanic, so Titanic never gets made now. You know, and it's like, God, like, you know, can't believe I fucked that up. And like, you know, just deleting these things that you love because you accidentally are aware of them too early is just such a consequence to time travel that was a fun thing to explore in that movie.
Yeah, definitely. Like, that's the thing, they pull off, because it's such a micro budget film. And like, to do a war movie on that scale and to do it in like a found footage style is so clever. And like I say, they're showing, like, you know, obviously they do a lot of archival stuff, which works so well. But then, yeah, I agree with you that it does get a bit too big, because they're showing you this like almost entire alternate universe of what could have happened. It just gets so big, and it's still so impressive that they pulled it off and kind of what you're seeing visually. But yeah, I did like it when it was more just these two girls in this room messing with stuff and just seeing what would happen. Ooh. It just had such an awesome flow to it, especially when it was just those two, because they're so charismatic on screen. Like, I love it. But yeah, the movie's fantastic, and like, it's so special. I have such a great memory of it, and it's great rewatching it after all these years. So yeah, hopefully people
just briefly check it out. It is funny that you say that you don't think it's rewatchable, because the second I rewatched it, and then knowing now I can watch it at any point, like, I have been itching to watch it again.
Yeah,
like, absolutely itching. Like, it really, like, I notice so much more the second time round, and I feel like I'll notice more the third time round, and just want to pick up on all the little nuances of when things start to shift.
Yeah, well, it being so short, I really love that as well. Yeah, the fact that the only special feature on the Blu-ray is a commentary as well, which I would love to hear. So I might have to put that on at some point. But there was one thing I noticed with the runtime, because on the back of the Blu-ray, it says 83 minutes. And I was like, in my mind, I was like, I could have sworn when we saw it at Fright Fest, it was like barely over an hour. You know, it was like around the 70 mark. And So I was like, oh, is this a different version or whatever? And then when you put the disc in to play it, the overall runtime of the disc that you put in, which is obviously from the start of any sort of production notes, and obviously there's a lot at the start because it's an indie production, to like the end of the credits is 78 minutes. So they already lie and just add an extra 5 on the back, which is funny for whatever reason. And then obviously, yeah, that's included in the preamble at the start, which is probably a couple of minutes, and a couple of minutes credits. So it is, yeah, it's pretty much a 70-minute film, which is what I remembered it being, which is perfect as well. Like I say, there's people need to experiment with that more, especially with indie films. This kind of, and that probably shows you why they probably felt compelled to put the number starting with an 8 on the back, because that was almost what they felt like they could get away with. But that's even worse in films that we see time and time again, where they're like, oh, it needs to be 80 or 90 minutes. Like, again, something like Host was like, what, just under an hour, I think it was. Yeah, experiment with it, man. Like, you don't need to be a slave to these runtimes. Like, 70 minutes is more than enough if it's an excellent film like Lola is. Like, at no point have I felt, you know, shortchanged that the movie's only 70 minutes. Like, I was still more than happy to pay full price for the Blu-ray. So, yeah, fantastic stuff. But yeah, we got loads of good shit to look forward to. We're in the middle of a packed month. So yeah, I'm guessing we'll see VHS next week because that is out. So people might have already seen it. I'm so excited, man. It's crazy to me. Like, my, you know, our love of this franchise from the early days of getting that first film and being such like early components of it, and then that big gap doing like my own research and contacting some of the filmmakers and chatting to them about the upcoming one when it was returning, and then getting early access to the last two films as well. It's crazy to me that there's like a new VHS that I haven't seen that's just out there. That's mad to me because I adore this franchise so much. But yeah, looking forward to it next week. And then, yeah, plenty of TV on the horizon as well, including that, the big one on Netflix, The Return of Mike Flanagan. So yeah, we'll obviously be doing a full show on that at some point soon as well.
Yeah, their Flanagan Creepshow is back on Shudder.
Yep, Creepshow is out.
How many episodes have aired on Shudder? It's weekly, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember.
No, one or two at this point, I think.
Yeah, I can't remember if it's all on Shudder at once and then it's like on AMC weekly.
Maybe I'm not sure. Yeah,
but yeah, it's certainly out there. And then yeah, we've got Goosebumps as well, which I'm really curious to see what that's like on Disney Plus. So there's a whole variety of horror this this spooky season. Very, very good stuff. But yeah, that was episode 366. Thanks for listening as always, and we'll see you again very soon.
See you later, everyone. Shut up, I can't. Mainly because I never could. How could I start now?